The art of growing a bonsai tree takes a lot of patience and a lot of care. Remember, growing a bonsai tree is the art of taking a regular tree and then artificially preventing its growth to produce a miniature tree. And this has been practiced for centuries over in places like China and Japan, and it's kind of caught on over here. It takes a long time. A small bonsai tree takes anywhere between 5 and 10 years to reach maturity. A full-grown, fully trimmed and presented bonsai tree can take up to 15 years or maybe even longer. In fact, one of the trees that is on display at the National Bonsai Museum has been living and being passed down from generation to generation since 1626. So these trees last a long time, and it takes a lot of patience. For example, here's one tree. One person took a photo year one, year two, year five. It progresses year 10, and then finally year 15. We get the full effect, all this very nicely positioned and trimmed and presented bonsai tree. It takes a long time. It takes patience. It also takes a lot of care. A lot of things that we don't normally do to plants and gardens. It takes pruning and watering and repotting. It takes trimming. It takes pinching. It takes wiring. It takes trimming some of the roots off, even up to, you know, maybe 20, 30% of the roots. So it takes a lot of care to produce a bonsai tree. Don't expect one of these things to spring up overnight. In fact, if you're one of those people who likes to start new things but then rarely finishes them, probably don't want to take up bonsai tree growing. This requires a long-term investment, lots of patience and lots of care. Jesus makes long-term investments in his disciples. He always makes long-term investments in his disciples. And he exercises extreme patience with his disciples. In fact, as we work our way through the passage this morning, we're going to see him demonstrating extreme patience with his disciples. Remember, they've been with him for 3 years now, and they're still not getting it. The very first thing that's recorded for us is a dispute arose among them about who's the greatest. Really, guys? 3 years with Jesus, and you're still talking about who's number one? So Jesus demonstrates patience, for sure. He also cares for his disciples by pruning them, removing something that doesn't belong there. And we're going to see an example of Jesus telling Peter, I'm about to prune you. I'm going to knock the legs out from underneath that self-sufficiency and thinking you can do something on your own power. So he prunes them, and he prunes them so they can bear more fruit. Jesus makes long-term investments in disciples. Now, that's good news for us, because if you are in Christ, if you're a regenerate believer, that means Jesus is committed to making a long-term investment in you. That's very good news. That's very good news. Now, we're going to ask this question, can we expect that same kind of patience, the same kind of care, the same type of pruning that he demonstrates with his disciples? We're going to answer that question as we get through the passage. So let's break it up into three sections. The first one is 24 through 30. If you look at the paragraph heading in the ESV, it says, who is the greatest? So here it is. A dispute also arose among them as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. And he said to them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as one who serves. For who is the greater, one who reclines at table or one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at table? But I am among you as the one who serves. You are those who have stayed with me in my trials, and I assign to you, as my Father assigned to me, a kingdom, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So it seems rather odd, as we start off in verse 24, it seems rather odd that a dispute like this about who's the greatest would just kind of spontaneously erupt at the Last Supper. Remember, that's the context. Last week we looked at the Lord's Supper. It was the Lord's Supper. It was the Last Supper, but it was the first Lord's Supper, and Jesus instituted that for his people and for his church. And it seems like in the midst of such a solemn, precedent-setting occasion that all of a sudden they start talking about who's the greatest. And that doesn't make too much sense unless we remember the context. And remember, in the Gospels, we have a distinct advantage over a lot of the other New Testament books because we can pull in and draw from the Gospel parallel account. So that's what we want to do. In the Gospel of John, when we go to the Last Supper, John includes something that none of the other Gospels include, and that's the foot washing. So we're at the Last Supper, and even though Luke doesn't talk about the foot washing, we know it happened because John tells us about it in his version of the Gospel. So it seems much more natural in this type of context for this dispute to arise because it was a common custom to get together and as a part of hospitality and just as a kind of thing that they did was to prepare for this formal meal by washing feet. Now, usually a servant did that. If there was somebody in the house, because washing feet was servant's work. The master of the house certainly wouldn't do that. The most honored guest certainly wouldn't do that. We'll let the servants take care of foot washing. Well, there were no servants. And so here was the situation. We really need to have our feet washed, but there aren't any servants. I'd do it, but I don't really think that I'm on, you know, I'm probably number one. Let's say James, Peter, John, we're the inner circle, so probably one of you guys should probably, you know, do the foot washing. And it's like, well, I'm maybe up a little, I'm not last, I'm not that guy, I'm not going to do the foot washing. So it seems much more natural in that context where we have this discussion, a dispute arising about who's the greatest, because whoever loses that discussion gets the task of foot washing. And of course, what happened? Jesus did it. Jesus got up and served them. So here's this discussion, and Jesus' response addresses this idea of servant leadership. And the first thing he talks about is the Gentiles. The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. They're called benefactors. Benefactors were these people that did a lot of civic good. In fact, in some places in the first century in the Roman Empire, the way to achieve public office was through first being a benefactor. If you had a lot of money, you could go out and you could give money towards all these civic improvement ideas, and everybody would take notice and say, "Oh, wow, that nice library, yeah. Oh, I really appreciate the Colosseum. Those new columns on the outside, those look really good. You know, have you thought about running for office?" And that's kind of how it went. But even if that wasn't the pathway, let's say you just got there through natural descent, or you're appointed, or you were in line for the throne, or somebody, you knew somebody and your family was on the inside and you became a governor of an area. Even the leaders that didn't get through the pathway of their own money being donated, even they wanted to be called benefactors because there was this idea that we wanted to maintain this reputation of being an essential part of the community. Even if those who ruled did so poorly, even if they did a terrible job, they still wanted to go on record as a benefactor. They still wanted to maintain their reputation as somebody who was essential for bringing about all these good things in the city. They wanted a legacy. So they wanted to be known as benefactors. Jesus says, "No, not so with you. That's not how it's going to work in my kingdom. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest." Jesus says, "No, I'm going to be giving you authority, guys. You guys are my apostles. You're going to get greater authority, but you're not going to exercise it like the Gentiles. That's not how it's going to work in my kingdom. The youngest." We remember the book of Job where Elihu allowed the three friends to speak first because why? They were older. They were older. And they really didn't have that good of advice. In fact, they got it wrong, and they were rebuked by the Lord at the end of the book. But he waited to speak because they were older than he was. If you remember in the book of Job, Jesus is saying, "Yeah, do that. Be one who is like the younger. Be one like one who holds back, who doesn't assume that your opinion matters more than everybody else. Be one that holds back and doesn't assume that you should be the first one to speak." He said, do that. Be like the youngest. In fact, what he's really telling them is, I want you to exercise not leadership like the Gentiles do. I want you to exercise servant leadership like I have, says Jesus. I want you to be a servant leader like I've been a servant leader to you. Remember, this is in the context of him washing their feet. Now, servant leadership has kind of gotten a bad rap even in churches because there's been a whole lot of emphasis on servant and not a whole lot of emphasis on leadership. I want us to ask this question. When we read through the Gospels, is there any question about who the leader is of this group of 12? As we will read through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, is there any question at all that Jesus is not in charge? No, not at all. Not at all. We don't see Jesus going around asking his disciples, well, what do you guys think? What do you think my mission should be? Or, hey, you know, I've been in Capernaum for a while. Why don't you tell us, where do you think we should go next? Peter, I've been kicking around this idea. Should I go on the other side of the Galilee? And then come back in a boat tonight? How much time should I spend in prayer? No, we don't see anything like that. Jesus issues commands. Jesus is leading. There's no question about that. And he expects loyalty to his authority. Now, Jesus is definitely exercising leadership, but he's doing so in a way that serves those he is leading. He doesn't ask them to do anything that he doesn't do first. So we see a balance. We see servant leadership perfectly modeled in the person of Jesus Christ. The one who reclines at table and has his feet washed is considered greater by the world. But he's saying, not so with you. And then he gets up, wraps a towel around his waist, and washes their feet like a servant. How about that? So Jesus models for them what servant leadership looks like. And then in verse 28, he says, you are those who have stayed with me in my trials. These are the ones that have been with Jesus from the beginning. All kinds of hostility directed at Jesus during his ministry. Not everybody welcomed him warmly, especially when he got to Jerusalem. He's been under pressure. He's been criticized. And let's not forget, oh yeah, there are men in Jerusalem, powerful men, who want him dead. They want this guy killed as quickly as possible. They're willing to pay money to get it done. Extreme pressure. People walked away from Jesus because his teaching was too difficult. People had expectations. We've seen other rabbis come and go in the past. Hey, you're not doing what rabbis should be doing, Jesus. Or messianic expectations. Well, we've got our idea. We think we know what a messianic person that should be doing, and you're not doing that. You're deviating from the job description. We don't like that. We're out. And they left. But the apostles had remained with Jesus. Is Jesus interested in loyalty? Absolutely. Absolutely. If you remember in Acts chapter 1, Judas, who was not of them, was gone. He committed suicide. And in Acts chapter 1, they need to replace Judas and take a place among the 12. So they cast a lot. The lot falls to Matthias. But you remember what one of the qualifications was? The one that really stood out? It has to be somebody who has been with us from the beginning. Just like here, Jesus says, you stayed with me in all my trials. The one to replace Judas. He's got to be somebody who's been with us from the beginning, meaning from John the Baptist's baptism all the way through his ministry up until the crucifixion and resurrection. In other words, when it came time to select someone to replace Judas as leader in the church, they said, we don't want any Johnny-come-latelys. I'm not interested in somebody who now wants to join us. Now after the resurrection, now after Jesus has ascended and is exalted. No, it's kind of like those stories you hear about the distant relatives coming out of the woodwork after somebody wins the lottery, right? They're saying, no, we want somebody with Jesus when he was dirt poor, when he was living in the street, when he was eating out of the dumpster, not after he won the $32 million Powerball, okay? not now. I want somebody who's been with us the whole time, who's taken the heat, and who has remained loyal. Where were you? Were you with Jesus when he was being confronted by the leaders? Were you with Jesus when he was being hated? Were you with Jesus when he was being crucified? If not, don't even think about applying. We're not interested. You got to be somebody that was with him from the beginning. So here he is talking about loyalty. You guys, I understand, this is at the Lord's Supper. This is at the Last Supper. You've been with me during my trials. You've been with me from the beginning. I'm assigning to you, as my Father assigned to me, a kingdom. Remember, this is not a reward for doing good works. He's saying you don't have a place at my table because you did a really good job of being a squeaky clean follower of mine. No, it's because of their relationship to Jesus. Their loyalty to him, which he had chosen them. They stuck with him. No, it's their connection to the king. I will assign to you, assign meaning decree or appoint or arrange, to you, that you is plural, to you apostles, sans Judas, the kingdom. Eat and drink at my table is a reference to the marriage supper of the Lamb. Sit on the thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. It doesn't get much higher than that. The apostles will indeed share in Jesus' rule, but they will follow the same pattern. Remember, the pattern is this: suffering first, exaltation second. That's how it was with Jesus. Suffering first, then exaltation. That's how it would be with his apostles. Suffering first in this life, then exaltation. But it's a promise to them. What does this communicate? It communicates to his disciples not only the idea and the concept of servant leadership, it also communicates to them, I am making a long-term investment in you. This isn't just for now. This isn't just for tonight. This isn't just for a season in your life. I'm making a long-term investment with you. I've been patient with you. I'll still be patient with you. I've been building into you. I'm going to continue to build into you. This long-term investment not only lasts this life, it's going to last for an eternity. I'm not going to leave you. This is a long-term investment. Well, let's look at the next section, Peter's denial, 31 through 34. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. Peter said to him, Lord, I am ready to go with you, both to prison and to death. Jesus said, I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day until you deny me three times that you know me. Both the words you, if you see in your Bible, you probably have a footnote. The ESV has a footnote after the you. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you. The you is plural. So what Jesus is